If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Levi's, Plow & Hearth, Adidas, Sephora, and Neiman Marcus. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. And it's easy to use. And you get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's R-A-K-U-T-E-N. Rakuten.com.
Sadly, it turns out that Tavistock is still in operation. Last June or July, I forget exactly which, we were all informed through the press that Tavistock would be closing down. They were told they were going to have to be closing down by spring of 2023, and spring is rapidly approaching, and it turns out that Tavistock is still operating, is still prescribing puberty blockers to children, and there doesn't seem to be any end in sight. Now, there's a lot of information to go through here because I wanted to look both at Tavistock still operating, its origins, and also some of the research that it is based on. So I'm going to try and get through this relatively quickly, so bear with me. But before I do that, as we're coming up to the end of Black History Month in America, I wanted to remind everybody that MLK is not, in fact, a conservative hero. And to vindicate my feelings on the matter, you should watch the premium video that I did of the same title on the website that I think is very good. I put a lot of hard work into this. I did a lot of research.
To the fact that you spent a lot of time and effort trying to research this and do it as well as you possibly could.
Well, it's a contentious topic. It's an important topic because the regime that we're on at the moment, one of the moral foundations of that regime is of this mythical view of the civil rights movement of the 1960s. Apart from those meanies in the Malcolm X sphere, all the other civil rights leaders and everybody else, they were just peaceful people. They just ignore all of those riots that kept happening every single year throughout the 60s, the actual race riots. They were peaceful. MLK preached non-peaceful.
Have we seen that before?
Yeah, exactly. It's that whole attitude. So you should check that out if you want to really learn what was going on during the civil rights movement and how it has negatively affected us today. It's, once again, very contentious, but if you give it a try, I think I can convince you. Anyway, let's go on to it. So this article is talking about how the Tavistock Gender Clinic ran out of control because recently, over the past few days, the Times in particular have been putting out a lot of articles on the Tavistock Clinic, seeing as it turned out that, hey, this thing is still open. What's going on here? So let's take a look at the backstory of this, because some might just think of the Tavistock Clinic as, well, it's just trying to help children. It's just trying to help some children who are experiencing distress. And I'm not going to be able to go into as much detail as I would like to with this, because YouTube, sadly, prevents us from being able to say certain things about gender dysphoria and the things that cause it and what it actually is. So you might have to look at some of our other premium content on the website if you want some more in-depth information there. But so it's all based around this thing called GIDS, which is Gender Identity Development Services. And it was founded in 1989 by a man called Domenico Di Kegli, an Italian child psychiatrist. His aim was to create a place where young people could talk about their gender identity with non-judgmental acceptance. And immediately, straight away, just there, the use of the word acceptance sets off alarm bells in my mind, because it's like, oh, there's going to be no critical thought applied to this. It's just, okay, we accept you. All right. In 1994, the service became part of Tavistock and Portman NHS Trust, and by the early 2000s, those working within GIDS noted that certain gender activist groups, such as Mermaids, and we've spoken about Mermaids before.
Oh, we have, yes.
Not an organisation I'm a particularly big fan of. They support gender-diverse kids and their family. We're exerting an astonishing amount of influence on kids. Now, for most people, as far as I was aware, Mermaids seemed to have been something that became very well-known only recently.
I think it was after there was some sort of spat with their funding.
In all likelihood, but it turns out that it was ever since the early 2000s, this organization has already been exerting a massive amount of influence and control over how these treatments develop. And given that they're a charity, non-profit charity, designed to support these children, I would say that gives them an incentive to ensure that there is a steady supply of these children to ensure that donations and funding keeps rolling in. That's just my view on it there, especially in regard to encouraging the prescribing of puberty blockers. Sue Evans, a nurse who worked at GIDS at the time, asked the senior manager why GIDS couldn't just focus on talking therapy and not give out body-altering drugs. According to her and another clinician, Barnes writes, and this is all part of a report, the senior manager replied, "It's because we have this treatment here that people come." So once again, setting out that there's a nice big incentive. If we don't have this treatment, if this isn't what we're known for, we might get shut down.
Mm-hmm.
And it clarifies that further in the article by stating that by 2020 to 2021, gender services for Tavistock accounted for about a quarter of the trust's income. So they have built the entire service on this house of cards built around this very dangerous and, in my eyes, very experimental treatment that they give to children.
I've interviewed people that have worked at the Tavistock, and they say that the entire infrastructure is set up to push out anyone that disagrees with their so-called philosophy of treatment.
I'm not surprised. It's how these sorts of places become the way they are. You get one, you get the radicals in, and then the radicals gatekeep anybody who isn't as radical.
It was founded by a radical. Exactly. So it's even more pernicious than that.
Yeah, and in the year 2000, the trust asked De Kegley, the originator of all of this, to draw up a report of who its patients were, and it turned out that most of GID's patients were boys with an average age of 11. And this, if you look back at the research from the early 2000s and back into the 20th century, seems to line up, because as far as we knew back then, when gender dysphoria was a much less common diagnosis for people, it was something ridiculous like 99.95%. of all people with gender dysphoria were boys.
And it was a largely male thing. I'm not sure it was quite that resounding.
I might be exaggerating, but I know that it was the vast majority, like 9 out of 10 at the very least, would have
been boys.
Something
like that, yeah.
And they would have developed it from a very, very young age. So say like the age of 6 or 7, they would have started to experience distress in their own body. And more than 25% of them had spent time in care, 38% came from families with mental health problems, and 42% had lost at least one parent, either through separation or death. This suggests to me, and I don't know exactly how I can phrase this, that perhaps the causes are not innate within gender dysphoria itself. Perhaps it could be considered a symptom, but that's maybe going too far for YouTube. I don't know.
I mean, childhood trauma can lead to something that I can't name on YouTube.
Yes. I'm sorry we're having to dance around this subject a bit. Just blame Susan. And by the way, bye-bye, Susan.
Yeah, I mean, I can't even talk about my professional opinion, right?
Yeah, because you've looked into a lot of the research as well, haven't you?
I have, yeah. And the idea that psychologists are being throttled on YouTube talking about something that they know better than YouTube about, well...
I don't know. Susan knows best. All praise and hail Lord's Lady Susan. Other problems such as anxiety and physical abuse were common among these people, and almost a quarter had a history of self-harm. And what they were basing a lot of the research off to be able to say that we can prescribe these puberty blockers to young children was a gender identity clinic in the Netherlands who in the late 90s came up with the idea of giving blockers to children under the age of 16. The Dutch clinic said that 12-year-olds could be put on blockers if they had suffered from long-term gender dysphoria, were psychologically stable and in a supportive environment. And this was known as the Dutch protocol. Now, from the research that I've done, the Dutch protocol is seen as like the gold standard of this type of research. The problem is that for the gold standard, it doesn't really hold up to any scrutiny. For one, I think it was exploratory research. So they were going into a field that they knew had basically no prior research done in it, so it's brand new, and they knew that they weren't going to get results that were going to be applicable to everybody and every scenario. Then there's also the fact that the people that they were testing on don't really apply to the kinds of kids that are being looked at the Tavistock clinic right now, because most of the people that they were looking at were boys, and most of the people that Tavistock and other clinics get now are young girls. And then there's the fact that the research itself was not done particularly well, or at least the results are not conducive to being applied to everybody, because they had a very selective process for choosing the kinds of subjects that were going to go through to the past the initial stages of the trial. And they basically selected for the people who were going to best take to this kind of treatment.
Yeah, normally these sorts of exploratory ideological studies, they don't have very good research methodology at all. And you can't really draw any conclusions from them anyway, because they're just one isolated study. Any academic worth their salt in the research sphere will know that you need at least several studies to start to get a picture of the nature of something, because one single study can be affected by various selection of biases.
Yeah. If I'm remembering correctly, I think what they had was they had the initial trial of the initial phase of the trials. And then once they got to the second phase, where everything was going to get more serious and they were going to start really taking, putting these people on prescription drugs, they had about 114, I forget exactly which, participants. And then they reduced those down to only the people who were most conducive to the treatment in the first place, which left them with about 70 participants for the rest of the trial. And even then, I think only 55 ended up being included in the final conclusions of the study, which took, you know, years, as you would expect. And it discounted any results that weren't supportive of the conclusions that they wanted. And this is the research that tends to get quoted and cited by every organization, including Mermaids, including the BBC, when they talk about these sorts of things. But anyway, let's carry on. So in 2011, Tavistock took an early intervention study to look at the effects of blockers on under 16s. Instead of waiting for the study results, GIDS instead eliminated all age limits on blockers in 2014, letting kids as young as 9 access them. That does not seem like due diligence to me.
No.
That seems highly irresponsible, in fact. And in 2009, GIDS had 97 referrals. By 2020, there were 2,500 with a further 4,600 on the waiting list. That just shows how much this thing exploded in that time. Less than 2% of children in the UK are thought to have autism. At GIDS, however, more than a third of their referrals had moderate to severe autistic traits. Interesting thing to note there. And when Dekegley started his gender clinic, the vast majority of his patients, as I mentioned, were boys with an average age of 11, and many had suffered from gender distress for years. By 2019 to 20, girls outnumbered boys at GIDS by 6-1 in some age groups, especially between the ages of 12 to 14. I wonder why that might be. I wonder if girls, especially girls going through puberty, are particularly disposed to kind of social pressures. Mm-hmm. And groupthink.
There is something that you can tell from the typical demographic of a specific thing that I can't name on YouTube, mm-hmm. is that when the patients change in their demographic details rapidly, it seems like there's some sort of social force at work, because normally you can get a decent profile built up of what's the most likely person to suffer from this thing I can't say on YouTube. And then you would be like, okay, well, if we have a sudden influx of people that are outside of this patient profile, then there must be something external going on here.
Yes, but the response that we get when we say this sort of thing, when we say that there's a social aspect to it, there's an aspect of social pressure. I saw it when I was a teenager. You would have saw it as well.
I didn't really see any of it when I was...
Oh, not this specifically, but young girls jumping onto trends.
Oh, right, of course.
Every girl became an emo, and every girl all of a sudden, and I'm not saying that this was better than what we have now. I'm not saying that it was a good thing. It was obviously a terrible thing. Every girl suddenly had a story about how they'd begun to self-harm. And this was a horrible thing at the time, but it showed to me that all of these girls used to be relatively well-adjusted and stable and normal, and all of a sudden, it became a social thing that a lot of them decided to do. And you got a lot of websites and Tumblr and other such things that were having actively promoting self-harm to young girls. It's an awful thing, and I see this as an extension of it to a certain degree. The effects of prescribing blockers to those under 16, although the children said that they were highly satisfied with the treatment, this is part of that same study that was done on this. Although the children said they were highly satisfied with their treatment, their mental health and gender-related distress had stayed the same or worsened, which suggests to me that you might want to start looking at different avenues. Maybe a few different avenues for how to treat these people. And once again, with this becoming a big social thing and a big thing among young girls, I thought it important to share this particular graph that Auron McIntyre put on Twitter, where he just captioned it, "Sorry, but this isn't Marxism, where you've got this graph, worldwide search interest, and we've got anorexia prior to about 2015 was massively searched, and gender and transgender was barely a footnote. And all of a sudden, around 2015, you see a complete role reversal, and transgender seemingly takes the place of anorexia." And once again, I've seen it happen. People would go on Tumblr, people would go on these websites and become anorexic because of the fact that they were being told and they had these websites encouraging them to do so.
When I was at university, one of the clinical psychology lecturers was saying how this was pretty novel at the time. It's not so novel now, obviously. It's been quite some time, but that they would have websites where people would be groomed into anorexia and things like that, whereby people would try and sell the benefits of it, which is ridiculous, of course, because it's, yeah, it's
it has
one of the
very,
most dangerous,
very long-lasting effects on people's health.
It's one of the most dangerous psychological conditions.
Yeah, I've seen the effects of it myself, and it's not good. It's not good at all. So we shouldn't be encouraging any variation of this type of behavior, as far as I'm concerned. There is another Times article where it's a first-hand account of what was going on and what was going wrong at Tavistock. And if you wanted to look into the Dutch study and criticism of the Dutch study as well, if you go onto the website and check the links, I did include the Dutch study itself, which is called the De Vries et al. Study. And then if you go to the next one, I've got this, which is a criticism of that and a very in-depth criticism at that.
You know that you've ruffled some researchers' feathers when they've gone to the effort of writing a whole paper basically debunking you.
Oh yeah, and this is a big one, and it's very, like I say, it's very in-depth. Like I said, though,
I'm familiar with those researchers as well.
Oh, are they good guys?
I think so.
People to be trusted? That's all right. I mean, the research they do is good either way, so that's good. But like I said, last year we did cover that they were being told to close, that a look had been done into Tavistock, which had concluded.
Oh, look, it's me.
It is. What a surprise. The research had been done into it, a study had been done by the Tavistock Clinic or the NHS themselves, saying that what they were doing was providing bad service to people. There was all these waiting lists. And we celebrated. I think a lot of people celebrated because we saw this as a victory.
Well, the way in which the announcement was phrased from the lady that announced the decision was that, yeah, we're closing this place down. It's no longer fit for purpose. And it seemed like she was indicating the fact that, yes, this what's been going on here is bad. We don't want this to carry on anymore. But now some time has passed and we've seen the actions of the government. It seems less and less likely.
Yeah, well, if we go to the article that we would have all been referring to when we, well, an article that we would have been referring to when this information came out, we can see what they were saying about it. And I think even at the time, it wasn't suggesting to me that they were shutting it down because they recognized this is a dangerous thing to be doing to children, experimental treatments and all that. I think they were just going like, well, we need to make the service more efficient. That's how I see it. We need to tighten up this ship. And in tightening up the ship, yes, we might help more people, but at the same time, we're still going to be doing these treatments to people. So what it was said here was that the regional instead of it just being the one service, because Tavistock was the one place that you could go to in the UK for this, instead, regional centres would be set up to replace the service and ensure the holistic needs of patients are fully met. And that was according to NHS English, after being warned that only having one provider was not a safe or viable long-term option. So once again, I don't think that this suggests that they were shutting it down because of the whole you're mutilating children. I think they were shutting it down because, we're not mutilating enough children quick enough.
Well,
that's what I'm getting from it.
Such vague bureaucratic language. It could mean any number of things,
that's,
right?
That's the problem. But when you combine with some of the other... When you combine it with some of the other things that the government is doing right now, some of the other moves that they're making.
I think when we look at the decision in hindsight.
Yeah, in hindsight. Saying, right? And when you look at the other, like I say, the other moves the government is making, it's not suggesting to me that they're going to be improving this service in any tangible way other than, well, they're going to be making it worse. So the service was criticized for its care of patients both inside and outside the clinic, also had record waiting lists, doctor reported concerns that some patients were referred to a gender transitioning pathway too quickly, and including one of the people they mentioned in this article, somebody who was quite famous, infamous a few years ago, Kira Bell, 25, who brought a high court case to the Tavistock Clinic challenging its use of puberty blockers. She said she was pleased with the decision to shut it. She was prescribed puberty blockers at the age of 16, but later changed her mind over her decision to transition to becoming male, and she argued the clinic should have challenged her more over her decision to transition. And sadly, because of this, because of the conversion therapy ban that's going to be coming in soon, that's going to be illegal. If you want to challenge people on their self-diagnosis of gender dysphoria, that's basically going to be illegal. Like I say, they're still operating. At the end of the day, that's what's important here. They're still operating. They've still got about 8,000 people on the waiting list for GIDS, and 1,000 children currently receiving treatment, including prescriptions for puberty blockers to halt the development of under 16s. The spring deadline will be missed, and no time frame is in place for the new hubs to open. The Tavistock service must be given 6 months' notice to close by NHS England, and is yet to be told of the next steps, meaning it will remain open until at least August. Great. Fantastic. And like I said, there's the conversion therapy ban, which might be coming in relatively soon. The government's been talking about this for years, but it seems that the activist pressure has been getting to them and they are going to be passing it at some point.
The Conservative Party just want to destroy their support from their own base, apparently.
Oh, yeah. Because
they absolutely have.
That red wall's going to be put right back up again as if Trump was there doing it by hand himself.
If only.
I know, if only. So what they're doing is they're going to be publishing a bill, and they say it will be published shortly, and it's looking to protect everyone, including those targeted on the basis of their sexuality or being transgender. We've spoken about this conversion therapy ban before, and I think it's important to point out, as always, again, I do not think it needs to be banned. If people are voluntarily choosing to go through these services, they should have the right to voluntarily do so. I don't necessarily think it's going to do anything for them if you're talking about gay people. I don't necessarily think you can talk somebody out of being gay.
No.
But if they want to see if they can, that's their right to do so.
Yeah, it's virtue signaling at a legislative level, isn't it? It's just writing legislation that actually serves no practical purpose, but they can wrap themselves in the trans flag, just like, yes, we're here for you. We're conservatives. We're even more supportive than Labour of you.
And besides that, when I was in university, I tried to do a documentary piece for my final project in my third year on conversion therapy in the UK. And I went on all these forums. I tried to talk to people. I even got in touch with some of the organisations like Stonewall to see if I constantly hear about people having to go through conversion therapy. I'm trying to do a documentary on it for YouTube. Can you get me in touch with some of them? No. Ironically, got stonewalled by Stonewall. And all of the forums, nobody knew anybody. And I immediately just thought after that, are they making a big deal out of nothing? Is that all this is? They're just making a massive big deal out of nothing. And but despite that, the legislation must not harm the growing number of children and young adults experiencing gender-related distress, this is according to the government, through inadvertently criminalizing or chilling legitimate conversations parents or clinicians may have with their children. Despite that, the legislation seems to be basically making anything other than purely affirming care for people, for young people, illegal.
It's not the government's business. They're not the, I hate to pull rank here, but they're not the ones who've studied clinical psychology, are they? And although there are certainly plenty of people who are doing horrible things, I think the fact that they're just politicians, just like, yes, you know this thing that I don't really know anything about? Let's just make a blanket decision on that.
Yep, that's just what the government does, isn't it? That thing I have no idea about, I'm deciding it now. There you go. That's how it works.
Government in a nutshell, yeah.
Yeah, and this is based off a particular study. And a study that was done it was a survey in 2018, and it had 108,000 people in it, and 5% of these 108,000 people who responded said that they had been offered some version of conversion therapy, and that's offered, while 2% had undergone it. And of the transgender respondents, 8% said that they had been offered conversion therapy, and 4% said they had undergone it. Now, I got the study up. We can go to the study. And I looked at the numbers, and I decided to crunch the numbers. And the study itself said that 13% of the respondents were transgender. So let's crunch those, okay? Mm-hmm. So of the full sample size, which was given, I think, as 108,100, 5% equal...
108,100, is that of just all conversion therapy people?
No. That's just of people who responded to the survey.
Okay.
And then 5% of that overall say that they were offered conversion therapy. So that comes out to about 5,405, okay? Then 2% is 2,162 went through conversion therapy, according to their own self-reporting. And of the transgender respondents, 13% of total respondents, that makes it 14,053. And then 8% of that being offered it is 1,124. 4% is of that total number is 562. So we're talking about minuscule numbers of people, less than 10,000 most of the time, less than 5,000, and in the case of transgender respondents who said that they went through conversion therapy, we're talking about less than 1,000. That's how widespread and evil this issue is. So that's what they're trying to do. That's the research that they're basing this off of, so that they can ban it. But let's take a look, a deeper look at that information. So this is the government's website talking about it. So this is who offered and carried out conversion therapy. And this is going through here. So we can see it was mostly faith groups. So mostly faith groups offered it. Other than that, we've got parents and guardians, person from my community, and you've got 11%, or well, sorry, closer to 12% people saying that it was a healthcare provider or medical professional. And if we go to the next one, where we see who carried out the so-called conversion or reparative therapy, it was the next graph down, I think. Yeah. It's just 50% faith organizations. There was about 30% healthcare provider, but let's be honest, that will just be talking, won't it? That will be, okay, before we go through any major surgery or any major treatment, let's talk. And apparently that's just causing distress to these poor kiddos. These 562 people just could not bear it. So what this is suggesting to me is that they want to criminalize having conversations with concerned family members and friends, and they also want to proscribe faith organizations and churches from being able to undertake services that really should be no business of the government's. That's what I'm seeing suggested here.
Well, it's certainly no business of the government's. I don't know whether faith organizations are well positioned to deal with the issues.
Whether or not that's the case, the only actual interview that I saw given by somebody talking about what they went through in this made explicitly clear repeatedly, I chose to put myself through this. I was given the choice. They said I don't have to, but I wanted to because I am gay and I am Christian, and I decided to try and do it. It didn't work. It was a waste of time, but he chose to do so. And if people choose to do so, that's their choice. The consequences that come off the back of that are their choice.
People should be able to choose what to do with their own life. It shouldn't be anyone else's business what decisions they make, as long as they don't harm anyone else.
Yeah, and I find it funny as well that this is just taken down to faith organization or group without specifying whether it's churches or a different faith, shall we say. So I question how this is going to work, say, if it's being offered by Muslims at a mosque, for instance.
Well, it won't be enforced like many of the other laws, where there seems to be an unwritten Muslim exemption to lots of our laws for some reason.
Of course. And if you want to look at the research in more depth that the government put out, then you can find, once again, in the link on the website, the actual document below. But yeah, there you go. That's a lot of research and a lot of information regarding the Tavistock Clinic. I hope it didn't bore you too much, but it's all very important to know to know why it's important and dangerous that the Tavistock Clinic is sadly still running.
If you appreciated that segment from the podcast The Lotus Eaters, you can go to lotuseaters.com to get access to all the premium content that's on the site, such as the premium articles we do, and audio tracks for silver and gold tier members, of course. If you'd like to find out what else is being put out, you can follow on Getter at lotuseaters_com on Getter. Thank you and goodbye.